Welcome to the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Podcast. My name is Natalie Nidham. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology to ancestral health practices, personalized interventions, and a very special interest of mine, peptides. Enjoy the show.
Hey folks, welcome back to the show. We have a great episode for you today. It is a bonus episode, so it's extra, if you will. And I'm super excited about it because it's one of those episodes where we're talking about someone who's done something to disrupt an industry. And we know that industry disruptors are always pretty cool. And you're going to be one of the first people to hear about this. Not too many people know. It's very new on the market. Now, before we jump into that episode, I do want to thank you, first of all, for being here. I'd love to encourage you, if you get value from this episode, then make sure you share it out with your friends and your family and your networks, because that's how we reach more people. And the other way we reach more people is by getting reviews. So if you're inspired by this episode, please make sure that you leave us a review. Just take a second, a quick review on whatever platform you're listening to the show on, and that'll help us to rise up the ranks, reach more people, and ultimately continue to get you amazing guests. All right, now let's thank a couple of our sponsors and talk a little bit about the episode. How tired are you of spending hours upon hours in the gym doing cardio with minimal results? Well, listen up, because I've got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you, and it's called the Carol Bike, the science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts and by me for optimizing health and longevity. Because here's the thing, too much of a good thing is going to age you, even too much cardio. Now, with Carol's revolutionary reduced exertion HIIT workouts, or we call them rehits, you can achieve double the health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. Studies have shown that by doing Carol's quick 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. That's amazing. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier, more vibrant life. And here's an exclusive offer for you. You can get $100 off your bike with code NAT. So don't wait any longer. Just visit carolbike.com and unlock your path to longevity today. Now, I did want to also mention one other thing. Carol Bike is not a one-trick monkey. It can also be used as a bike to do cycling programs. You can do long-distance cycling. You can test your VO2 max. It has a ton of features. So the most exciting one, of course, is being able to get that workout done in 5 minutes or even 10 minutes. But it's got lots of other tricks up its sleeve. You've got to check it out. All right, let's talk a little bit about this episode. Optimizing your gut microbiome is arguably one of the most important things you can do for your health, as it plays so many integral roles for entire body health and, frankly, longevity. And this is why in this episode of the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Podcast, I chat with Chidozie Ojobor on the importance of the microbiome's influence on human health, particularly in the gut-brain connection and when mental well-being. But we all know that microbiome affects immunity, affects cardiovascular health, metabolic health, the whole nine yards. He discusses the role of butyrate, leaky gut and leaky brain, probiotics, diet, and gut diversity in promoting a healthy microbiome. The conversation also covers the impact of modern lifestyle, antibiotics, the surprising impact of colon cleansing on gut health, and that one might surprise you, and how to get accessible gut microbiome testing. In particular, the testing done by Vitract, the company that he co-founded with his business partner. Chidozie Ojobor is a PhD, a molecular biologist with over 12 years of experience in medical microbiology research, and the co-founder and chief science officer of Vitract. In his early research years, he worked on human rotaviruses in Nigeria that caused severe gastroenteritis in children. After that, he moved to Toronto and proceeded to earn his PhD in molecular genetics from the University of Toronto. During his doctoral training, he developed, through genetic engineering, novel therapeutic entities that target disease-causing bacteria, such as the ones found in complex biological ecosystems as the gut microbiome. These tools he developed worked with high specificity and precision, making them the ideal candidates for targeted therapy. Dr. Ojabor's works in the fields he worked in have been well cited by numerous scientists across the globe. Now, to learn more about this test, about VITRACT, or to get a test for yourself, you can go to www.vitract.com, or you can follow them on Instagram at VITRACTOfficial. And then if you decide to order a test, make sure you use code NAT10 and get yourself a discount off this already beautifully priced test. All right. Now, one more sponsor to thank. If you're anything like me, you may find it challenging to commit to regular meditation practice. We know that meditation offers incredible benefits like reduction in stress, improved deep sleep, as well as a balanced nervous system. Now, the problem is it takes a long time to get good at meditating. Now, if you're ready to start reaping these benefits, you need to check out Sensate. Sensate is an innovative infrasound resonance device that, when used in conjunction with the sessions provided in the Sensate Companion app, can help to reduce stress and improve your overall well-being. This device emits infrasonic sound waves that synchronize with the app's soundscapes, delivering deep relaxation within 10 to 30 minute sessions. So what does that mean? If you're watching me on YouTube, I'm holding up the Sensate right here. And what it is, it's pebble shaped. It's about the palm of your hand and it vibrates on your chest bone. And that way it basically tones your vagus nerve. Sensate not only helps release immediate stress and anxiety, but it also builds long-term stress resilience, improves heart rate variability, and even enhances the quality of your sleep. For me personally, Sensate has been a complete game changer, both for my mental health and for when I'm drifting off to sleep at night. I just love drifting to sleep with this thing. Now, take a step towards improving your overall well-being and stress levels by using code NAT at GetSensate.com. And on that note, let's jump into this episode.
Hey folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.
Welcome to the show, Shadozi Ojabor. It is such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Natalie. It's nice to be here as well.
Yeah, well, this is our second time recording because my computer died the first time. I'm not embarrassed to admit it. I mean, a little bit, but not too embarrassed. And you were gracious enough to say yes again. So here we are. So we are going to dive into all things microbiome. Shadozi, when would you say we really started to, because, you know, a lot of people will say that there's still so much we don't know about the human microbiome. But when would you say that, you know, we started to get traction, like we started to turn the corner? Was it like 10, 15, 20 years? Like how long ago was it?
Yes. It is true that there's so much we don't know, but, you know, it is also true that, you know, we have actually made a lot of great progress in our understanding of the gut microbiome, especially with the advent of, you know, next generation sequencing. One of the biggest issues with using culturing method, which is like the old microbiology method of trying to identify bacteria, is you have to be able to culture it in the lab. But unfortunately, over, you know, 75% of the microorganisms in your gut they are anaerobic. They cannot be cultured.
So they die.
Exactly.
Right.
In the presence of oxygen. And so what happens is that we had to like start figuring out, you know, better ways to really understand them. And that's why, you know, the advent of the next generation sequencing brought a lot of progress to the field. So now you can, you know, actually go and identify the DNA of the bacteria. And by finding the DNA of the bacteria and doing a lot of post-sequencing processes, bioinformatics and all that, you can identify the type of bacteria that's there, even down to species and strain level now. It's remarkable.
Yeah, that is remarkable. So before we dive any deeper into this little world, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to be in this world? Because you have a pretty good story. I remember from the first time we recorded, we have a great story. So I'm like, okay, we can't leave that part out. What brought you to the world of this fascinating world of studying this universe, really, of bugs in the human gut?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually started my academic journey by trying to really understand how viruses cause gastroenteritis in children. So I started with really doing a lot of work with rotaviruses. I did that in Nigeria. But then after that, I had the opportunity to reunite with my first love. I call it my first love because it's bacteria, you know. Bacteria is, I say it's my first love because it's easier to work with. They grow so fast. If you mess anything up in the lab, you can literally just wake up the next day and go back to the lab and start up your experiment again. So
yeah.
So I moved to Canada to undertake my PhD, and I was developing these novel therapeutic tools against drug-resistant bacterial strains. And for me, it was like full circle because prior to that time, I had lost my sister to a bacterial infection back there, right?
And sorry.
So, yeah, thank you. And so for me, that was even like the very first reason I was very interested. I was interested in microbiology because she had died of typhoid fever, which is caused by Salmonella typhi. And so now, fast forward to when I was in my PhD, I was developing these novel therapeutic tools that could target disease-causing drug-resistant bacteria. And that was when I started to get fascinated about the microbiome, because the tool I was developing, they're called bacteriocins, which are these entities that are produced by a set of bacterial strains against other strains that are coexisting within the same ecological niche. And they kind of like use this as like ammunitions to, you know, to outcompete the other strains, because of course you're competing for food resources and all space and etc. So I was basically trying to understand why a particular bacteriocin will target this strain and not target this strain. And that was where I started to get a full appreciation of the potency of such tools. We could use such tools to modify complex biological ecosystems. And there is no biological ecosystem that is as more complex than the gut microbiome. And this is where my love for the gut microbiome started. And so far, so good.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Okay, so let's dive into kind of the school of the microbiome for a little while, for a bit before we get into other areas. So one of the things that I think is becoming more and more apparent to people as we progress is the importance of this microbiome, which a lot of people are now referring to as its own, almost like an independent organ of the human body, for every aspect of human health. And I don't know if we want to pick them apart and talk about the different ways, but you know, the microbiome, it seems like the microbiome affects pretty much almost any chronic disease process that we know of. So whether it's cardiovascular disease or the immune system, where a lot of people will talk about, you know, your immune system lives in your gut. Mental health, even neurodegenerative diseases, there's becoming a lot of links. Maybe talking a little bit about, you know, that two-way highway, the vagus nerve that runs between, you know, it used to be that I think it was widely accepted that the brain would communicate, would send messages down to the gut, let's say.
Yep.
But I think what's come out more, you know, in more recent history is, wait a minute, there's messages being sent back the other way.
That's right.
So did you want to talk a little bit about how the microbiome really gets involved in all these different things, like whether it's how we manage our blood sugar or whether we're gaining weight or losing weight, like all of these different things. How is it that these bugs are involved?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a great question. It's also a big question because
yes. You know, you don't have to go deep on everything.
It's also like a very big question, but yeah, I consider the microbiome to be like the portal for human health generally. And you know, as you said, it plays a huge role in almost everything: cardiovascular health and mental health, metabolic syndromes, name it, all of them, because there's trillions of organisms that are, you know, existing in that niche. And it's not just about the type of organism that lives there, it's about what they're doing there. All right. So we know about the beneficial organisms, but what are these beneficial organisms? Why are they beneficial in the first place? They're doing very important things like producing very essential metabolites, such as your short chain fatty acids, your acetate, your propionate, your butyrate. We know of the role that they play in human health generally. Butyrate, for example, I call butyrate a very key marker of health. It doesn't matter any kind of health, from, you know, metabolic health to cardiovascular health, butyrate plays to digestive health, they play huge roles. First, we know that, you know, they're the primary source of energy for your colonocytes, right? We know that they play a huge role in, you know, maintaining the integrity of your gut barrier, of which we know that if that barrier is denigrated or insulted in any way, it basically just leads to the development or the progression of many other diseases. And so that's why it's unsurprising when you look at people that have serious, like, chronic inflammatory issues. It's unsurprising when you start to see that they have very reduced amounts of these beneficial organisms that produce these important metabolites. And so, you know, one thing to always think about in terms of how the microbiome connects to all these forms of health, which I'm pretty sure we're going to dive into shortly, is it's beyond the taxonomic profiling. It's beyond just the name of the organism that's there, the type, the taxon of the organism that is there. It's also about the functional level. What are they producing? They produce beneficial metabolites. Some of them also produce metabolites, which when they accumulate in the intestinal tract can cause problems.
So let's drill down a little bit on the mental health side. I know that, I mean, there's an increasing number of studies coming out linking people with disrupted microbiomes,
right,
and, for example, depression.
Right.
Right. And is that due to specific species that are either overrepresented or underrepresented? And I think that overrepresentation, underrepresentation is something maybe you could speak to, because I think very often it's not as much a question of good and bad, good or bad, as it is proportional representation. You know, like even the bad guys, even the so-called bad guys have a place.
That's right.
But it's when they overgrow or when they become more dominant that we get into trouble. So is there, you know, are there specific things that people need to look out for example, with things like depression? Because I believe, and I actually, there's someone in my life who's suffered from quite a lot of mental health issues who finally started to change their, has been able to figure out a way to change their diet and improve things, and is actually starting to feel better. This is over and like beyond what medication has done for them.
That's wonderful. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the gut and the brain are connected in very remarkable ways, primarily through three different systems: your neural system, your endocrine system, and your immune system. And what I mean by that is that, you know, your gut microbiome is modulating all these, you know, different systems in ways that they send signals and make communications to your central nervous system. And of course, you know, the gut microbiome itself has its own nervous system, which is called the enteric nervous system. And we've seen this, and you were mentioning people, for example, that have depression. We've seen this in people that have depression. We know that a lot of people that have depression, depression tends to be associated with a compromised intestinal barrier. In which case, one of the things that we've seen in academic literature is they tend to be, have, you know, people, depressed people tend to have low levels of, you know, these short-chain fatty acid producers. But the consequence of that is that certain things are then able to cross from, you know, the gut to circulation, things like, you know, food particles and pathogens and, you know, some of these metabolites, they cross over to the other side and they instigate this, you know, chronic, you know, inflammatory state, which is not beneficial to them. And so at the immune state, we tend to see symptoms like neuroinflammation in people that have depression. And the whole idea there is that because you're experiencing intestinal dysbiosis, it is causing some sort of dysfunction at the immune level, which is then crossing from your gut down there to your brain. And we also see, you know, very interesting things. It's not just, you know, it's not just depression. We've seen this even in children that have autism. We've seen, you know, an enrichment of certain, you know, bacteria in the intestinal tract of these children. An example is Clostridium. And, you know, Dysphovibro. And these are organisms that we know produce high levels of things like propionate, which is also short-chain fatty acid. Interestingly, propionate is able to ride on the vagus nerve from the gut down to the brain. And when it's in the periphery of the brain, we know that an overproduction, an overabundance of things like propionate actually contributes to the deficit in behavior that we see in autistic kids. And these are interesting. We also see things like, you know, when they produce toxins like tetanus toxin. We know that tetanus toxin actually can cross the blood-brain barrier and cleave things like synaptobrevins, which are these synaptic vesicles that are important, you know, for, you know, the neurodevelopment. And these are things that we see that are deficit in children that have autism. So the gut and the brain are, you know, super, super related. For depression, we have, you know, seen over 500 research papers actually that pinpoint the role of the gut and the brain in people that have depression. Another interesting example that I can think of here is the role of things like lipopolysaccharides. The people we've seen in studies that individuals that actually report that they have depression tend to have high serum levels of LPS, which also correlates with high levels of fecal LPS. Now, what are these LPS in the first place? They're endotoxins. So you look at a certain group of bacteria, the gram-negative bacteria, the outer component is made up of this lipopolysaccharides. And these lipopolysaccharides are primarily made up of lipid A and oligosaccharides. They are highly pro-inflammatory. So in situations where you have an altered gut barrier, what happens is that these lipopolysaccharides then gets to the other side of the intestinal tract and make direct contact with the lamina propria, which is where most of your immune cells are resident. And then that causes that kind of storm, that uncontrolled pro-inflammatory reaction, which we tend to also see to be reported in people that have depression. It's a fascinating relationship.
Yeah, it really is. And actually, I've also spoken to a couple of people recently that will say that people who have a leaky gut very often have what they're calling a leaky brain, where the blood-brain barrier becomes compromised as well. Like the blood-brain barrier is the big protector, right? Yeah. It's there to make sure that your brain, and to the point where sometimes even delivering certain drugs and nutrients can be a problem because you can't get them across the blood-brain barrier.
That's right.
And yet people with compromised gut integrity, a lot of these people will say that will carry over to that blood-brain barrier, where if you've got leaky gut, there's a reasonable chance that the barrier at the brain also is compromised. Is there... You know, there are strategies people use to repair the gut.
Yeah.
Do the same strategies work to repair the blood? Like, will they also repair the blood-brain barrier, do you think? Or
the problem is upstream of that, especially when you're talking about the gut and the brain in terms of, you know, the gut-brain connection. It is that a lot of times, and we've seen this in academic literature, where there were interventional studies where certain foods and probiotics were introduced to cohorts of people that had depression, and then they followed them over time and they saw that their numbers, their depressive symptom numbers actually dropped significantly. We've seen this repeatedly in academic literature. So what's happening there is that by repairing your gut barrier, you're just preventing the escape of toxins and metabolites and all of those things out of where they're supposed to be. And this brings me back to discussing really what dysbiosis is, because a lot of times people talk about dysbiosis, and when people talk about dysbiosis, they only address it in terms of, you know, the composition of your intestinal flora. But it's beyond that. It also includes the relative expressions of the different metabolites that are being produced in your gut ecosystem. But one other factor that, you know, should always be thought about is the spatial organization, that is the localization of the bacteria from where they ought to be to where they would then be when your intestinal barrier is insulted. And this is what we see in people that have depression, because they have leaky gut. Organisms that are supposed to probably localize within the intestinal lumen or in the gut epithelium, they go to the other side and then they instigate this complex inflammatory reaction. It is in those situations that we tend to see that things can then ride on things like maybe the vagus nerve, or those toxins can then send other signals that can take these metabolites to the periphery of the central nervous system. And there they actually perform their actions.
Wow. That's impressive. It's amazing. these little things. So you've mentioned butyrate a number of times, and about how sometimes people are deficient in the microbes that are responsible for creating our short-chain fatty acids. How effective is supplementation of butyrate? Like, you know, like, is it a good idea for people to be taking butyrate, or are there certain forms of butyrate that are better than others?
Yeah, absolutely. There are actually studies that have shown that butyrate supplementation helps to, you know, improve the symptoms that people are having, from like, you know, leaky gut to insulin sensitivity and et cetera. But, you know, I like to say that it's beyond just supplementation with the butyrate itself. The key here should be to actually arm your microbes to be able to produce this butyrate, especially the microbes that have that metabolic freedom to produce butyrate from different substrates. A very key example is Fecalibacterium prostensis. It's an obligate anaerobe in the intestinal tract that is known to be the largest butyrate producer. And the reason it's the largest butyrate producer is that it can actually make butyrate from different substrates. It can make butyrate from acetate. It can make butyrate by just, you know, fermenting your dietary fiber. And so, and there are foods, we know that supplementation with certain probiotics actually also lead to concomitant increase in those bugs in your intestinal tract. And so we you know, always encourage that people take, you know, prebiotics and food and some of these probiotics that are known not just to increase the abundance of the probiotics themselves, but they also help to increase the abundance of other beneficial organisms within the intestinal tract.
Okay, well, the obvious next question is, what are the foods? What are the things that people need to make sure are in their diet to try and, as much as possible, encourage this production of, encourage those species to make, give them what they need to make butyrate? And I guess the other question is, if you're deficient in that particular species, which I can't remember, I think it's Fecalo something or other. It just rolls off your tongue, and I'm sitting there trying to memorize it phonetically. but is it better to supplement the Fecalobacterium themselves, or do you want to feed them certain foods, or both? Yeah. Because I know for me, for example, I was very low in acromantia, like I almost had none. It took me 3 months of supplementation with acromantia and certain nutrients that we know feed the acromantia to really kind of help that population to reestablish itself.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the problem is that you can't actually buy Fecalibacterium in the market because
it's anaerobe, right?
It's anaerobe. It's very, very difficult to grow. Which means that, you know, you tend to supplement them with food that actually increase the abundance in the intestinal tract. And we know that one, you know, major dietary source is fiber, right? Because
any fiber?
Yeah, fiber from grains, seeds, fruits and vegetables, primarily. We tend to see a lot of enrichment in, this is very consistent in study, it tends to be a lot of enrichment in organisms like Fecalibacterium and other organisms, so like Rosaburia and Blautia, which are all other, you know, butyrate producers. And we have also seen that another way to actually enrich them is by taking certain probiotics, because these probiotics, like certain strains of probiotics, Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium, have been shown to able to degrade, you know, when you increase the amount of those organisms, they're able to degrade some substrates, which then become substrates for this Fecalibacterium also to feed on and then bloom in the intestinal tract. So that's more like an indirect way of increasing them
in
the gut.
So when you're taking a probiotic, so probiotics is another one of those things that I think, I mean, it's pretty widely accepted that probiotics is a good thing, but, you know, over the last little while, people have been talking about, well, you can't just blindly throw any probiotic in and think it's going to be good for you.
That's correct.
And also, a lot of people will say, well, you know, you've got such a huge number of both in sheer numbers and also in diversity in the gut, that probiotics is like a drop in the bucket. It's barely relevant. Do you want to speak to that a little bit? Like in terms of, you know, what makes a good probiotic? And we're going to talk a little bit later about how do you know what probiotic you need and what you may not need?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to, and this is why we encourage people to actually, you know, be very, very careful when they're selecting the probiotics they take, because you have to be very, very definitive even down to the strain level when taking probiotics, because probiotics belonging to the same species, to different species, but the same genus can actually have opposite effects. We've seen this, for example, in people that have that are trying to lose weight, the association between probiotics and things like obesity. We've seen that certain probiotic like Lactobacillus paracasei or casei plays a huge role in, you know, weight loss. Whereas Lactobacillus reuteri, we've seen in academic literature that it actually has the opposite effect. So that means that, you know, when you're looking at probiotics, you want to make sure that you're looking for the specific thing that that would actually impact, you know, your symptom or help to alleviate your symptom. Now, in terms of whether probiotics are important or not, it depends on the situation. Right? There are situations where people have completely zero amount of certain bacteria, like Akkermansia. Like, we're running microbiome tests with people and we see that certain people have just zero. You know, how do you actually seed them? In situations like that, you have to seed your gut with some amount through probiotics. And then afterwards, you can then, you know, increase the abundance by feeding them with, you know, prebiotics to make the resident organisms grow. So in situations like that, there are situations where you actually have to take probiotics. But we always say that there is nothing that actually feeds your intestinal tract, your gut microorganisms, I mean, more than the kind of food that you eat. Take for example, there's a group of hunter-gatherers in modern time that we know in Tanzania, the Hadza tribe. You know, very interesting study that was done with this group showed actually that they had over 700 species of bacteria, you know, when their gut was sequenced, versus an average person who lives in California that has about 270 species.
Wow.
You can imagine the huge difference.
Wow. Right? And is that because the person in California has basically over generations, species have just disappeared, which we'll talk about why and how.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
We should, like if there was ever, and I know that there isn't really a holy grail of a healthy gut microbiome, which I'd love you to touch on that a little bit. But if there was, it would be something with that kind of diversity.
Exactly.
And yet I would think that the holy grail of your gut microbiome is going to be dependent on maybe where you live. Like, won't it be affected by geography, climate?
Yeah. Geography plays a huge role. Lifestyle, because geography a lot of times is tied to your lifestyle, right? People who live in a particular locality are more likely to eat the same kind of food or something similar. And so we tend to see that for, you know, this group of people who are known to be hunter-gatherers. And the interesting thing about hunter-gatherers is that they kind of like have a really, really spread out balanced way of eating. All right.
Yeah.
You know, they from shell foods to plants to animals to this, so they're getting all of that. And so it makes sense that we are seeing that the diversity is huge. Not these people have never taken an antibiotic, a probiotic in their entire lives.
Yeah.
All right.
Or an antibiotic for that.
Or an antibiotic, you know. And so diversity, we know that when you're eating a more rounded kind of food like the hunter-gatherers, then you're able to increase your gut diversity. But what exactly is the implication of that? We know that gut diversity is associated with, you know, good health, you know, and when we talk about diversity, we're talking about the richness of your gut as well as the evenness. And so I think it's important to talk about this a little bit, because a lot of people just think about gut diversity in terms of, the total number of bacteria in my gut. Yeah, that's one piece of it. But if you and I have 500 species in our gut and we're, you know, but you have just two species making up 90% of the 500, we cannot exactly say that your gut is evenly spread out. And so these are some of the things that we have seen in individuals who are living or eating the kind of food that group of people, these hunter-gatherers, eat. Very, very diverse gut ecosystem. And that tends to correlate with many other things like longevity, you know, cardiovascular health, metabolic health. So it's not just that, it's there. There are studies that have actually drawn that correlation to improvements in people's life and health.
Right. But I would think that if you take that person, your Hadza hunter-gatherer, and you throw them in a city, First of all, the diversity is going to go out the window, I would imagine, because they can no longer live the, you know, part of it, like you just alluded to. I mean, yes, it's the variety of foods that they eat, but it's the lifestyle that they're living. And, you know, they're not washing their hands with antibacterial soap. They're not gargling with antibacterial mouthwash or brushing their teeth with fluoride. And like, you know, maybe this is a good opportunity to talk a little bit about, you know, what is really severely, I don't want to say destroying, but what's impacting our gut microbiomes so severely to really shift it. Because I would think like even a small child who ostensibly in like born into an urban city is only going to have as much diversity as their environment and their parents and their allows for.
Yes, absolutely. No, absolutely. You raise a good point. Actually, we think that the reason people who live in civilized nations or communities actually tend to have reduced diversity is just because, you know, of the lifestyle. Like you're eating more ultra processed foods, you know, you're doing all of that. You probably have more access to antibiotics, and you know, they're wiping out the beneficial organisms in your gut. And you know, there's an interesting study that actually showed that when you compare, you know, the gut profile of these people that live in, you know, California to the people that live in Tanzania, who are these hunter-gatherers, that the organisms, they found out that the genes that were enriched in the gut profile of the people living in California were genes that were associated with response to oxidative stress. All right. So these were genes associated with response to oxidative stress. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because it's probably a response to that chronic low-grade inflammation that almost everybody who's not eating right is experiencing in civilized nations. Of course, your microbiome would have to adapt to that when there is a chronic state of inflammation. And so these are some of the things that actually impact, you know, the gut microbiome: antibiotics, lifestyle, sleep patterns. You know, people who live in those places tend to sleep better. All right. It's like, you know, there is the hustle and bustle here. It all impacts. We know that cortisol through the gut-brain axis impacts the gut microbiome in a remarkable way. So all of these different factors actually play a role in the way things play out.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people that would say our world has changed so fast that we haven't had a chance to adapt to it yet, right? Mm. Like, so for example, like exposure to non-native EMFs gets talked about a lot as a stressor on the human system at every level that can have a negative impact. Mm. And there's a certain number of people out there that will say, yes, and they believe that over time it will become a hormetic stressor in the sense that we will eventually adapt to it. And it'll just become part of what our bodies learns to cope with. Yeah. But in terms of the reduced diversity, do you think there's any chance that maybe, I mean, it's hard to say, but if you took a healthy person from California who doesn't have mental health issues, doesn't have metabolic disruption, you know, who's a pretty healthy person, they probably would still have a much lower number of organisms than your hunter-gatherer person, but that might be because they've adapted to their environment.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it bad. It just makes it different because they're in a different place.
Yeah. That, I mean, yes, they might have much lower, you know, taxonomic bacteria than the other person who's, you know, living in Tanzania. But it also doesn't necessarily mean that they're less healthy, that someone living in California is less healthy. And I think it's important to mention that because we have to think about the microbiome at the functional level as well. So you and I can actually have different, you know, taxonomic profiles, but at the functional level, we are more similar than dissimilar. So we, you know, bacteria, you have bacteria A, I have bacteria B, but both of them are producing beneficial metabolites. And so that's also something to think about. And I think that is why we're very excited about the progress that we are seeing in next-generation sequencing, where we can go beyond just looking at taxonomic profiles to then measuring, you know, the things that these organisms are producing and looking down to even strain level. Because, for example, when you're looking at, you know, the microbiome at the strain level, you can identify strains that are environmental isolates from strains that are clinical isolates. So you have a species, but you want to, if you drill down to the strain level, it can give you a sense of the source of that organism. So to your point, you know, some of these guys are not washing their hands. They're not taking all those things. Some of these organisms are probably going to be picked up from the soil while they were farming, and they're going to ingest them. Those organisms will, you know, find a place in the gut, somehow colonize there, and then thrive. And then over time, that becomes a thing. So it is a very, very complex evolutionary process. And of course, you can't take away space and time from evolution. So the adaptation you speak about, yes, it would happen, but it's very difficult to measure in a short period of time because this is something that happens over a long period of time.
Yeah, no, for sure. I just think like, and one of the things you mentioned, which I think is so fascinating, and I feel like we often underestimate it in other areas of the body as well as the gut, is that there's redundancies built into the system.
Yeah.
We don't rely on just one pathway or one microbe to produce our butyrate. We don't rely on, right? And so I think that that's why that holy grail of the perfect gut microbiome is never going to, it'll never materialize, because it's almost like you'll have however many people who all have a good functioning, well-balanced gut that brings them good health, but they're all going to look different.
Yeah, exactly. Right? They're going to look different, especially at the taxonomic level. But there are things that you look at in the gut that give you a sense, a signature of health and disease. All right.
Right.
You know, and we've talked about some of them. You look at, you know, the beneficial organisms, your probiotic bacteria, these guys that are producing your vitamins. It's not just short-chain fatty acid. They're producing vitamins. They're producing neurotransmitters. All right. They're producing all of these beneficial metabolites. So you look out for them. You're also producing like longevity factors. There are many organisms in the intestinal tract that have enzymes like myrosinase that are breaking down things like, you know, glucosinolates to isothiocyanates that play a huge role in, you know, anti-cancer, anti-aging, you know, that have anti-aging properties. And so, you know, we have to think at that level of what these microorganisms are doing at the functional level, and not just pretty much, you know, bacteria A and B, etc.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is such a great point. And that's a point that, you know, we've spoken a few times, and every time it boils down to, figuring out who's there is great, but what you really want to know is what the heck are they doing? What are they making?
Exactly.
And, you know, and this really interesting, you know, you can imagine like the drama of the microbiome, like different species competing with each other. And it's that competition that actually is can be good unless you've inadvertently given the advantage to the wrong guy.
Exactly.
And maybe we can talk a little bit about that. I think that people get that taking antibiotics, generally speaking, is not great news for the gut microbiome. But I think we would also have to say that, you know, sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes taking an antibiotic is better than letting your body, your system deal with something that could overwhelm your immune system and really make trouble for you. So, so can we talk a little bit about taking antibiotics? Like, will the gut just bounce back, or do we have to take special probiotics? Like, I remember once going to a lecture. Do you know a guy by the name of Nigel Plummer? Okay. So he worked with Genestra, but this goes way back. Okay. And they said that they did studies that showed that if people took, they had this antibiotic care kind of probiotic that they recommended people take while they're taking their antibiotics, because what they showed is that by using it while they're taking the antibiotic away from the antibiotic. So let's say you're taking your antibiotic at night, you would take this in the morning or vice versa, that their microbiome bounced back faster when they were done from the antibiotic than if they didn't.
Interesting. That's really interesting. There are conflicting data on that, and that's why I said that's interesting.
That's interesting. Okay, cool.
Because there are actually studies that have, you know, alluded to in the direction of what you just said, you know, either taking the probiotics concurrently with the antibiotics or immediately after your antibiotics. Most studies actually kind of like recommend more like immediately after your antibiotics, so that you recolonize or repopulate there. But there's actually a recent study that showed that, you know, actually it made things worse for that individual. And
really?
And I think, yes. And I think this is where, you know, people need to take a little bit, a step backward to start thinking about why do we possibly have this kind of conflicting data in, you know, situations like this? One is the microbiome. We have to think about the microbiome as maybe one of the factors that can actually give us a sense of respondents versus non-responders. We've seen this in, you know, people that are taking FMT. You know, the microbiome can actually give them a sense of whether they're actually going to be good responders or non-responders or late responders in itself. Mm-hmm. That might be what we are seeing with situations like this where there are conflicting reports. What is the structure? What is the actual structure of that person's microbiome prior to taking the antibiotics? So that might actually influence what happens after the antibiotic regimen. And one of the ways to also think about a healthy microbiome is the resilience of your gut microbiome. A lot of times when you take antibiotics, especially for a short period of time, your gut ecosystem will go back to what it used to look like. Except if you're taking like prolonged regimen of antibiotics, studies have shown us that that actually has a way of disrupting your, you know, your gut profile such that it can actually give space for, you know, other antibiotic resistant pathogens to then start to bloom or other organisms that were not there before.
Right. And it won't bounce back. So how long typically is long? Like, you know, typically a person gets an antibiotic course, I don't know, like a week, 10, I mean, it's been a long time, but let's say a week to 10 days, generally speaking. But, you know, are you talking about things like, you know, for people who have like cystic acne or something and they get given these antibiotics, like long-term systemic antibiotics, like are we talking months? It takes months kind of to disrupt that balance?
Yeah. And you know, people are different. It also depends on, you know, whether people have other comorbidities too. So, you know, so you might actually be taking antibiotic and the antibiotic is doing its job. It's clearing the pathogenic organism that you're taking it for, but you have another maybe non-infectious disease that's there, that's probably pro-inflammatory, that can, at the same time, you might actually be experiencing a lot of inflammation that is further breaking down your intestinal wall. So yes, the disease-causing pathogen is not there, but then something else is happening under the surface that is also setting, you know, the stage for development of further disease. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult. But what we know in academic literature is we know that prolonged usage of antibiotics, like 1 year usage and above, actually plays a huge role, And we've seen this, for example, in children that, you know, that take up to, you know, there's a study that showed that children that take up to six rounds of antibiotics recurrently between the ages of zero and two, they are 35% more likely to develop autism than children who do not.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, we could say that that's more correlation maybe than causation, because could we say that maybe the reason why they need so much antibiotic might also be underpinning the development of autism? It may be a chicken or the egg thing, but it doesn't help, that's for sure.
It's obviously more correlational. We've seen this in depression patients too. Like we've seen studies that have shown that, you know, the more intake of antibiotics actually, you know, predisposes you to the development of depression. By comparing the odds ratio in the two different groups, people taking antibiotics versus people not.
Well, you brought up such a good point about the resilience of the gut microbiome, right? Because I think that, and I mean, definitely when I was working more as a nutritionist, I would occasionally come across people who would say to me, ever since I had this, like they would refer back to a health event that required them in some cases to take an antibiotic. And it wasn't for a year, but let's say it was for a couple of weeks or a month, but they felt like something shifted at that point and they were never able to really fully recover. And, you know, could it be that in those individuals, they were less resilient, like their microbiome wasn't in that great shape to begin with. And then the antibiotic was kind of like the final straw.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. We see this with people that have post-infectious IBS. And I say this that, you know, I would say that about 60% of people that have IBS actually developed IBS after a pathogenic infection. maybe, okay, you know, the and for IBS specifically, we know that food poisoning actually plays a huge role. It's actually beginning to look more like a causative role than just correlational for some type of IBS. You know, Campylobacter jejuni, Salmonella, Shigella, pathogenic E. coli, all of these four organisms have something in common. They have what we call like the CDTB toxin, which we know actually, you know, facilitates some sort of autoimmune reaction against a very, very important protein, the host protein, which helps, you know, in the cleaning wave of your bowel. And so there are studies that I've actually shown, and this is a very fantastic studies by the group of Dr. Mark Pimentel, where they've actually shown that, you know, when these toxins get into the body, they elicit these immune cells. But then because there's a part of this toxin that actually looks like the human cell, the human protein, the vinculin, it causes autoimmunity. So there is the cells begin to target vinculin, wow, which is your own cell. But what is vinculin itself? It's part of the, you know, the cell cytoskeleton. It helps in that cleaning motion. So when you wake up in the morning and, you know, you hear that growl, you know, it's the cleaning waves in your upper bowel. And when that can happen, what then happens is that, you know, the food that you ate from yesterday still sits there. And that then becomes a breeding ground for bacterial overgrowth. So, which is why it makes sense when you think about people that have IBS having comorbidities like SIBO. It is because, mm-hmm, you know, there's a problem with the cleaning wave, but it all started, if you trace it back to the root cause, you'll see that 60% of them, it all started because they had food poisoning. And this food poisoning is bacteria agnostic. It can be Campylobacter, it can be Shigella, it can be Salmonella, it can be enteropathogenic E. coli, but they have something in common. These are different organisms, but they have something in common, and it's that toxin.
Hey folks, are you tired of feeling tired? Do you always hit snooze, then slam your head straight back onto that pillow? With all the problems you have to take care of at work, at home, with your family, with your friends, it's no wonder you feel so tired. You got a lot on your plate, and you take care of a lot of different things. And if you really stop to think about it, who the heck takes care of you? Well, Magnesium Breakthrough could be an answer here. It is an all-natural supplement that helps you reduce fatigue and sleep more peacefully. It even strengthens muscle and improves your heart and brain function. Now, while most magnesium supplements are not full spectrum, Magnesium Breakthrough is the only magnesium supplement on the market that contains the optimal ratio of all seven essential types of magnesium. Imagine having the strength and energy to get out of bed every morning and face the day boldly, courageously, to be able to show up as your best self and keep that energy up through the day and into the night. So if you want to feel more energized and get the best night's sleep you've had in, well, forever, check out bioptimizers.com/bionat. Make sure to use code BIONAT, because by using that promo code, you'll also unlock free gifts, up to 2 travel-sized bottles of Magnesium Breakthrough. So once again, that's bioptimizers.com/bionat. Make sure to use code BIONAT. And now let's get back to the episode. I'm trying to figure out, there's so many different ways we can go to our next destination here. So in terms of protecting the microbiome, we've talked about a few things. So number one, don't get food poisoning if you can avoid it, which of course nobody sets out to get food poisoning. I know that. But what about, like, what are some of the most common things that you see people doing,
yeah,
that you observe that are the most detrimental to the microbiome?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that people do is this colon cleansing. You probably have heard people who are like,
really?
Yeah.
I've always wondered about that. Okay, tell.
Yeah. I mean, we know that, you know, a lot of times, I know people do it because...
You mean like hydrotherapy? Like... The colonics.
You know, people, you know, a lot of people do it. Oh, I want to cleanse my... But a lot of times it's like, for me, I think it's a waste of time, because if you actually have a you know, resilient microbiome, things are going to come back to the way they used to be prior to the time that you did it. But then if you think about it functionally, you can also be wiping out the beneficial organisms that are actually in your gut prior to the time that,
yeah,
that's, so that's one thing. And I've seen a lot of gastroenterologists, some of the people that we work with, that, you know, completely just you know, argue and say you shouldn't do that. They think it's actually bad practice. I'm talking about, you know, integrative gastroenterologists who actually have a good understanding of,
interesting,
of the role of the gut microbiome.
And so are they talking about people who do it once in a while, or are they talking about, because there's people that will do this like chronically, like constantly.
Yeah.
As a practice.
Doing this constantly, it's bad.
And is that the same as enemas, for example?
What's enemas?
Enema, like having an enema, like people give themselves enemas. At
enema.
Home.
Oh.
Yeah. Sorry. Oh. Sometimes I talk a little too fast.
Yeah. So you were saying, what about enema?
Oh, because you know, you in the space, like in this biohacking space, you have all these people who are very big on, for example, coffee enemas,
yeah,
or you know, and so is that similar? That's not the same thing, because you're not flushing the system out in the same way, right?
Yeah. To be honest, usually, like, our understanding of the microbiome makes us know that we can actually influence the microbiome without having to be so invasive.
Yeah.
All right. We can, you know, except you have a very, very chronic, you know, disease that, you know, all these different forms of manipulation have not been able to help you. Like you can manipulate the microbiome. Food is one way to manipulate the microbiome. Lifestyle is one way to manipulate the microbiome. It makes sense when people start doing things like FMTs for like very chronic, like Clostridium difficile, or what we call Clostridioides difficile infection, which we know. A lot of them are very, very, you know, very, very resistant to antibiotics. So you're throwing in antibiotics there, but they're resistant. Nothing is happening. But, you know, even FDA approved Rebuta, you know, November last year, which is, you know, FMT therapy for Clostridioides difficile infection. So except you are at that point where every form of manipulation that you have tried doesn't work, then with the guidance of a practitioner who knows how this is done, you can try it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't encourage anybody to just do anything blindly. Yeah. There's a lot of things out there.
For sure. So for people who don't know, FMT is fecal microbial transplant, right?
Fecal matter transplant. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when you take the fecal matter from another individual and transplant it into the one person, which is, it's a daunting process. Now, I mean, I've heard of people who've done really well, you know, like there are, I read a book a while ago talking about that it works. It can work sometimes with autistic kids.
Yeah.
It can work in cases of like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis for certain people. So these are people who have like major disruptions, and there's almost like no balance to be found anymore. And and it's a bit of a Hail Mary, right? I mean, I don't think anybody takes it lightly. To your point,
no. Exactly.
It behooves us to try everything else first.
Exactly.
Okay. So, I mean, as you've said, like a poor diet, too many processed foods, too much sugar, probably too much of anything, chronic stress, disrupted sleep and circadian rhythm,
antibiotic overuse.
Even I would think also, like, even athletes have to be mindful, right? That it can disrupt their microbiome. Like when you're getting into the overperformance in the performance field.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, for such a resilient trillion bunch of people, organisms, they can be a little sensitive sometimes. Okay, so let's talk about testing, because that's the field that you've gone into. So you're sitting there doing your thing, and all of a sudden you decide, all right, what the world really needs is the right test.
Yeah.
And maybe talk to us a little bit about that transition that you've made. I mean, you're still in academia, but you've also now got a foot in this other space, clearly because you detected a need or a void. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So I co-founded a company named Vitract, and what we're basically doing is we're providing gut microbiome tests to, you know, individuals and clinicians primarily who are interested in improving the gut health of their patients. And primarily the reason why we got into this space was that, one, we wanted to, we feel like there's a litany of you know, evidence and scientific knowledge that we know about the microbiome and how it relates to different kinds of diseases. And we thought that it would make a lot of sense to actually try to condense some of those things into tools that clinicians can use to better understand the gut health of their patients. So that was the first reason why we thought about building the test. But the other reason, which is very, very pivotal in clinical setting, is, you know, affordability. Almost every single microbiome test that is out there is unaffordable, you know. And, you know, adding to the fact that all of these things are out of pocket, all right? So if somebody has to pay $400 or $600 to do just one test, how are they going to retest, you know, in the near future? Because the best way to actually use tools like this is you try them now prior to interventions. You use those natural-based interventions, and then you go back and then test again and see if there are shifts, and also see if they correlate with the symptoms that you're having. So we built this test, one, for to improve how comprehensive microbiome tests can be, but secondly, it is to make them affordable. And it's a 16S ribosomal RNA test, which is, we use the 16S gene of a bacteria to actually identify the bacteria. So all these bacteria have, you know, 16S genes, and which make them unique. So bacteria A has a unique 16S gene, the other one has a 16S gene. So by identifying the 16S gene and then doing a lot of post-sequencing processing, we can identify which bacteria is which and identify them down to your species level. But we just don't show you how much bacteria is there or what bacteria is there. We show you the relative abundances of all these bacteria. And then we also stratify them into beneficial bacteria, that is bacteria that are associated with health versus bacteria that are known to be associated with disease. So we stratify them into probiotic bacteria, commensals, and pathobionts. And probiotic bacteria are the beneficial organisms. Like Natalie and I have been talking about them through the podcast. They're producing all the short-chain fatty acid, all the vitamins, all the neurotransmitters, all the longevity factors, all the detoxification factors, etc. Your commensals and your gut to establish that homeostasis, your anti-inflammatory state, etc. Your pathobionts are organisms that live harmlessly in your gut, but when they overgrow, they can actually set the stage for the development of disease. An example is the sulfovibro. If they overgrow, we know that you can have a bloom, an accumulation of hydrogen sulfide, or, you know, there are organisms that can cause an accumulation of methane, and all of these things can actually pose set the stage for disease development and progression. So we show you all of that. We also give you insights into the metabolites that they're producing, and then we tell you how you compare to other people who have taken the test. But lastly, we give you a sense of the dietary recommendation, which is personalized to you based off on your gut microbiome result. And these come in the form of food, prebiotics, probiotics, supplements, and lifestyle changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very comprehensive. I think one of the things that one of the many things that I love about it is you even link to studies.
Yes.
So you're very transparent in the sense of, you know, and I think it's important in this space because things are moving so fast.
Right.
That it's, you know, like I can't imagine how many papers you read on a regular basis, but things are moving so fast that,
right,
you know, you almost have to show people where you're getting, where it's all coming from, so that if you have to make a shift or a pivot somewhere, you're able to kind of back it and go back and say, oh, well, this is what this was saying, but now it says this. But the thing that you touched on that I think is really interesting, because we hear from some of the B to C tests, like business to consumer tests, straight to consumer tests that are out there, you'll have a few people doing it together, and they suspiciously seem to get the same recommendations from each other.
Yeah.
And this came out in the call that we did together with my community. And they were like, well, you know, I did test, and I'm not going to name it, test ABC. And everybody I know who did that test got the exact same recommendation. So, and so they're a little suspicious. And you basically came out and said, look, the reality is that in many cases, they're not that personalized. They're giving more general. And it's not to say that people don't get benefit from it, because if you get someone, let's say, who's on a SAD diet, like your standard American diet, any recommendations towards real food is going to benefit them.
That's right.
But you guys have definitely taken it up a notch. And you know, we've done my test twice now, we're going to do it a third time. And I keep thinking that, you know, you're eventually going to give me permission to eat more meat again. Like, I'm not cutting it out completely, but you know, there's stuff going on in my gut that apparently I'm not supposed to eat a lot of meat, which makes me sad because I'm a bit of a...
And talking about meat, didn't you try the carnivore's diet recently?
Well, not recently. I started leaning towards it. You know, okay. It's too bad we didn't have your test like 2 years ago, because I would say that 2 years ago I was eating much more of a Mediterranean based, which is that's my roots, right? I'm Mediterranean. And so as a matter of fact, I had friends who called me, to this day, they call me the veggie Nazi, because I'm always making, I was always making vegetables. Like if I had a dinner party, there'd be like five different vegetables in addition to chicken, fish or meat or whatever on the table. And then I got influenced to a certain degree. Plus it's super easy to just eat meat.
It makes life
a lot more simpler. But I've never gone full carnivore for very long, full disclosure. But I also feel, because in my gut, I didn't feel, it never really resonated with me. Having said that, I slid into a pattern. And I think this is what happens to people. Like, you get really busy and you slide into a pattern where you fast a little bit too much because it's really easy. Right. Mm-hmm. And you move towards more of a mono diet because again, it's simpler.
Yeah.
And it reflected in my test. Like, it was my test, you guys, I'm never showing it to anybody, but it was not a pretty sight. The only thing that I did well was, like, last summer I did a test that showed I had virtually no acromantia. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I tested with you, I had done 3 months of a certain supplement, with the phenol boost, and my acromantia had reestablished. When I repeated the test, I kept using those phenols and I overfed my acromantia. And I'm like, come on. Like, I just tanked it right? But I would highlight, that's the beauty of a test that costs you $150, right? Is you don't, it's still $150, but it's a lot easier decision in 3 months to say, okay, I've been really good now. I've been eating a lot more diversity in my diet.
Yeah.
Now what?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I agree with you. This is one of the fascinating things about the test. You can try things out. I do a lot of experiments on myself, when I feel, that I have some sort of inflammation, I take my sample, I do the test, because the gut microbiome changes across two scales temporarily and, more persistently, that's more permanently on a long-term scale. So sometimes when I'm interested in the short-term changes, I just take different samples, run them. It's fun to look at. But for clinicians, we've seen them gain a lot of insight, and I think where the biggest joy is if those insights actually correlate with the way you feel, which is what we saw with you. And I think that this is one way for people out there who are listening to actually also, you can, do a litmus test for any test you're trying out. You want to know if the test actually works. You feel a certain way, do the test, see if it can tell you something. Try the intervention, see if you feel better. End of one experiment. They're usually the most fun.
It's the name of the game. A couple more questions. So
yes,
there's a couple of like red flash points when it comes to microbiome testing and when we're doing stool testing in particular. And so this whole idea that if I eat very differently for a few days, it's going to influence the expression of my microbiome, of what's going to show up in a test. And then the other idea that, it's like the microbiome is not necessarily, and I'm going to have to get graphic now because there's no other way around it. It's not necessarily reflected uniformly across all the poop you release in a day kind of thing. And so how do you know that this one spec, how do we compensate for this one spec? Like, you know what I mean? Like, these are the arguments that people make against these tests. And to me, it's any information is good information, but.
Yeah, I think there's two questions there. So I think the first question is, that short-term variability that you tend to see and how that can actually have clinical utility. Like, a very good thing we just talked about, carnivorous diet, actually one of the really interesting studies associating carnivorous diet to the microbiome, placed two groups of people on a complete carnivorous diet, animal-based diet, and another group on a well-rounded diet, just for 4 days. And in 4 days, they saw remarkable changes in certain bacteria for the people eating carnivores diet, Bacteroides, Alistapes, Bilophila, these are all bile-resistant organisms, which makes sense because bile acids are being produced to metabolize the fat that you're getting from the meat. This is just to say that in a short period of time, you can actually see changes. All right. But how do these kind of changes really correlate with the state of your health? Now, one is the changes, you have to think about the gut microbiome in one, the transient changes you're seeing, but two, the stability of your gut microbiome. So in an ideal world, you should be taking, you should be doing, you know, taking 10 different samples across a short, like a space of like maybe 7 to 10 days and then getting a sense. But also, you know, there's only so much you can do when you're considering cost and all of those things. And so what we encourage is you know, when your symptoms are heightened, when you're having all of those symptoms, you take your microbiome test, you see what you get from there. And then you try the interventions. Most people we work with are working with clinicians. So they try the interventions and you take it after 3 months, because we know that 3 months is a good enough time for you to see some changes in your gut microbiome. And this differs from person to person. Some people are quick responders. Some people are late responders.
Yeah.
It's how you also learn about yourself.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, on the carnivore thing, I think the jury's still out. I mean, you still, you know, when you step into the carnivore community, certainly there's a population of people that it seems to be working for them. And why and how that is. And there's definitely, like you said, you know, after 4 days, you're going to see a marked shift in one direction, but who knows what the adaptations are over an extended period of time, right? Yeah. And their microbiome is obviously going to look different than someone who's an omnivore or someone who's a vegetarian or a vegan. But as we said earlier, it doesn't mean it's bad. It's just different. And it's about how is it expressing in their health markers is going to be the truth. So, you know, I think that at some level in the world, we need to move into a place where we can accept differences and be curious instead of be oppositional, because the fighting between the vegans and the carnivores is epic.
it's insane, you know. But you know, virtue in this sense, I think, lies in the middle. We can borrow a leaf from, you know, back to the hunter gatherers who have a more well-rounded kind of diet. You know, if you're doing like extreme carnivore or extreme vegan, like you're going to see certain deficiencies in, you know, I mean, this is irrespective of the, you know, the different communities, the arguments. It's like, you know, being on the extreme side of things will actually impact, you know, your, especially your microbiome. We know that the microbiome, for example, can be stratified into different enterotypes based off on your long-term lifestyle. If you're eating more animal protein, more animal diet, we know you're going to increase the amount of your bacteroides. If you're eating more plant or carbohydrates, you're going to have more Prevotella. And an overabundance of those things play a role in the way your body harvests food, metabolize substrate, you know, produce in beneficial, harmful, you know, metabolites or toxins respectively. So, you know, I think in my opinion, I sit in the middle, and so far so good. My gut microbiome tests have been coming out well.
For sure. Well, and I also, you know, if we go back to the hunter gatherers, I think that if we think about it, there's probably times because of the way nature works where they are more plant-based and times when they're more carnivore and times, you know what I mean? Like it's like nature forces these patterns on you because there's no grocery store to go to, you know? And so if you didn't catch a big animal in a while, you're going to have to survive on something. And you may be adapted to fasting to a point, but you can't fast for 3 months and be functional. You're going to eat what you can get your hands on that's not going to kill you first. And then you'll go back and you'll catch something big and you might gorge on that for a while. And then, you know, it's I just think those patterns, but they're built out over a long period of time instead of being just one thing.
One thing, exactly.
Okay, so a couple more questions about Vitrac, because I think people are going to be curious about this. How, aside from the personalization and the way you deliver your information, there's certain things you don't look at, right? Like to keep the cost where it is and to give the type of information that you're giving, you've really stuck to bacteria, right? Like you're not looking at viruses and your favorite virus. Well, they used to be your favorite. You gave up on them, bacteria. But like the viruses and the the yeasts and the like all the other guys.
You raise a good point. Yes. So the 16S gene is only found in bacteria and archaea, which means that the VITRAC test only, you know, accounts for the population of the bacteria and archaea in your gut. And we decided to start with this, of course, for obvious reasons, affordability, but also because, you know, bacteria make up actually about 90 to 95% of your gut. So they're playing the hugest role in your gut health. So we thought we should start from there. We are actually currently working on metagenomic sequencing, which actually caters to fungi, viruses, protozoa. And then if you're also interested in looking for specific antibiotic resistance genes, you can also find them there. So those are obviously more expensive, but we want to create that, you know, that option for people who want to look a little bit more and who are also probably interested in strain level categorization. So
okay, so that'll be like another test down the road. But in the meantime, you've got this very powerful, very affordable test that looks at this particular snapshot and can be influenced by your choices and decisions all those things. Okay, I love that. Okay, I think we're good. I think, I could keep firing questions at you and putting Shidozi on the hot seat, but I can't knock you off. So how about you tell people where they can find more information about VITRACT and how to order a test? I know we have a discount code for the audience, but first, why don't you tell them where to find all the
You can find VITRACT at VITRACT.com. It's VITRACT. VI means we are revitalizing your intestinal tract. That's the idea.
I love it. I didn't used to like the name. I've totally come around on the name. I'm all in.
It grew on you.
It totally grew on me. I was like, VITRACT, what does that mean? And VITRACT totally makes sense to me.
Yeah. So VITRACT.com or VITRACT.ca. And we sell the test for $150 US. If you're in Canada, it's 210 Canadian dollars. But if you are Natalie's, if you subscribe to Natalie's channel, you're definitely going to be getting for cheaper than that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So our code is NAT10, you guys. And Shidozi, thank you so much for your time today and last week. I've had technical upon technical issue. I can't wait to see what's coming down the pipes for you guys. This is really exciting. And thank you for all that you do.
Thank you very much, Natalie. It was a wonderful conversation and well done. Great job on what you're doing. It's always good to listen into your channel.
Thank you so much.
Before we wrap up today's episode, I'd love to invite you to join my Biohacking Superhuman Performance community, aka the BSP community. This is a place where we dive deeper into longevity science, peptides, and bioregulators. If you're looking to get into the nitty-gritty on these larger topics, this is the place for you. Plus, we hold weekly Q&A sessions, either with myself or with special guests for live interviews for you to join, and you can ask questions to the community for everyone to answer along with myself. It's an amazing community. If you want to join, head over to natnidham.com/BSP-community to join or find the link in the show notes. Thank you so much for your continued support and for tuning into today's episode. I wish you all the best this week in your biohacking superhuman performance.
Thanks so much for joining me on this episode of the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes because that's what helps us to be heard and to be seen. If you'd like to connect with me directly, or if you'd like to leave any comments, or if you have any questions about this episode, please reach out to me directly through my website, natnidham.com. And of course, if you're not already a member of the Biohacking Superhuman Performance community on Facebook, that's where you'll find me every day. It's a short application. Just answer a couple of questions and you're in and interfacing with other amazing biohackers. Thanks again, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode.